For over a decade now, the UW Population Health Institute has been providing a snapshot of how healthy communities are straight across the country. And we explore the annual county health rankings and roadmaps with a focus on Wisconsin, of course, here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. So to measure health factors, the Institute works with loads of data like high school graduation rates, obesity, smoking, the quality of air and water, income inequality, and more. How healthy do you think your county is? Does your family have the resources it needs to live a healthy life? Are you in a food desert or live near a factory? What is that like? Join in 800-642-1234. Sherry Johnson is director of the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison. Sherry, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's start with, why do you do this? Why does your institute track health data of every county in America?
So for more than a decade, the county health rankings have looked at the many factors that impact health. And the goal is really to spark conversations at the local, state, and national level about the ways in which conditions that people live, work, and play in drive the health of everyone in a community. And they're meant to really then spark action. We know that each community has both assets and needs, and this data can really be a starting point for communities to dig in and look at where their strengths and weaknesses are, and then work together to find solutions to assure that everybody has a chance to live a long, healthy life.
Have you seen instances and examples of those conversations, that action, that change that is maybe leading to more health equity in communities?
Yeah, there's some exciting examples in Wisconsin. Particularly, there's some culture of health prize winners in, for example, Algoma, Wisconsin, that have been working together for many years to really address the root causes by looking at ways to increase access to education. The same in Menominee. The Menominee Nation has been working hard to increase high school completion rates. So, yeah, there are at least a couple of really wonderful examples that people can look at the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Culture of Health Prize here in the state of Wisconsin. But we know that even communities that have historically been ranked really high have work to do. So sometimes the overall health of a community looks great, but when you dig into the data, there are wide gaps between groups within a community that still need to be addressed. And those gaps are often related to a history of policy and practice that has advantage some groups and disadvantage others. And so we're hoping that communities that are both have been in the higher ranks and in the lower ranks will dig into the data and really look to see how they can make sure that everybody has the conditions they need to thrive.
Sherry, looking into the gaps a little more, can you kind of paint a picture for us? What does it mean for a county to be healthy or unhealthy?
Right. So our model has existed for about 10 years actually more than 10 years. And it really uses data that we have publicly available over time with coverage, as you said, for nearly all the counties in the state. And it includes data about the physical environment, health behaviors, social and economic conditions, and clinical care. And so we really encourage people to look across all those factors and to look at the trends within those factors to see what's improving and what's not improving. And so we know that things like access to employment and income are really important for community health. Things like access to broadband, which is a new measure that we added this year. So communities can look to see what's going on with access to broadband, and we saw how important that was as we're all responding and recovering from COVID-19 pandemic.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sherry Johnson, who directs the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison, and we're exploring her institute's annual county health rankings with your insights as well. How healthy do you think your county is? Have you seen changes over the years? Does your family have the resources to live a healthy life? Maybe you live near a factory or away from grocery stores in a food desert. What is that like? Join in at 800-642-1234. Sherry, looking a little more closely at broadband, you started collecting statistics on broadband access. How is broadband related to the health of a county?
Right. So think about what we've all needed to do during this last year and a half. So broadband is really critical, for example, for access to telehealth services, whether it's telephysical health or telemental health services. Having a broadband connection at home has allowed many people to continue to access healthcare or more easily schedule a vaccine. Or think about the ways in which broadband has mattered for our school children. For those children that have broadband access at home, they've been able to continue with some measure of continuity their education. But if broadband access isn't available, we run the risk of some groups of children not having access to both the educational content, but also the social connection through online learning that has been so critical. So broadband is becoming more and more like a utility, like electricity or water. It's so necessary. Think about who's had an opportunity to work from home, needing that broadband access to be able to work remotely if your job or job sector has that as an opportunity. So it's been really critical in the pandemic, but many of those needs existed even before the pandemic, and the absence of broadband access is then a factor that can contribute to gaps in opportunity to be healthy and to thrive.
I'm just thinking here about this pandemic and your raw data inputs from the data in 2020 in a pandemic. And I'm wondering, have you seen any anomalies, or was this data different to handle as you put in all your calculations and your inputs?
So this data does not reflect the actual COVID-19. So
okay.
Our data has a little bit of a time lag. So
gotcha.
The current data does not include data that would reflect the COVID-19 pandemic. But what it does reflect is the conditions that existed prior to the pandemic that we know have a relationship to whether people can live long and well. So, for example, even before the pandemic, the conditions that shaped health and opportunity were contributing to a 12-year gap in life expectancy across racial and ethnic groups nationally. So Black and Native American people were living at least two fewer years than the national average, and Native American and Alaskan Native, Black and Hispanic people were already facing higher unemployment rates compared to white and Asian households. And so those are the conditions that were existing before the pandemic, and which many researchers are demonstrating are contributing to the higher rates of illness and death.
You know, when you hear that phrase that your zip code can tell a whole lot about your health outcomes and your quality of life, I would imagine mm-hmm. that you really see insights there.
Absolutely. So, you know, we use a pithy statement where you live matters for your health.
Mm-hmm.
And you were referring to it when you talked about if you live close to polluting factories or don't have access to clean water, those are not individual level factors, right? Those are factors that are affecting whole zip codes or places. And those conditions arise not from only from an individual's choice to live in a certain location, but they're really nested in a set of policies and practices that have afforded some people the opportunity to live in a healthier place and others not. And that relates to structural racism, things like residential segregation and the lack of opportunity to move to a neighborhood that has high quality schools or where your home is going to increase in terms of its value and increase your family's wealth.
We are looking at the annual county health rankings produced by the UW Population Health Institute. Sherry Johnson with us, its director. What do you want to learn from these rankings? How could quality of life improve in your community? What changes would make a difference in your health and well-being? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Sherry Johnson on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we explore the annual county health rankings produced by the UW Population Health Institute. I'm Kate Archer-Ken. Thanks for being here. As part of this work, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation gives out a prize honoring communities that prioritize the health of their residents. This year's nine finalist communities include Green Bay, and the Culture of Health Prize will be awarded this fall. How is the health of your community? In what ways do you struggle to live a healthy life? And what day-to-day challenges could your community address? Join in 800-642-1234. Sherry Johnson directs the UW Population Health Institute, stays with us for 10 more minutes. Sherry, let's look more closely at Wisconsin communities. First of all, Green Bay getting the attention here in this year's Culture of Health Prize. What do you see happening in Green Bay?
Well, you know, I'm not at liberty to share the the application. So the competition, for lack of a better word, is ongoing. And our colleagues that lead the Culture of Health Prize are learning so much as they go around virtually to visit communities all across the country who are really at the forefront of seeking opportunities to work together across sectors and by centering the experience of people in community who have the most knowledge about what the assets are and what the needs are. So we are grateful to learn from communities across the country. And I can't comment specifically on any of the pending finalists.
So how about Ozaukee County, the healthiest county in Wisconsin again this year? What stands out?
So what we know about the healthiest counties across the whole country are that often they are benefiting from strong social and economic factors. So income and employment and rates of high school completion and graduation are often drivers of overall health. What we also know that is that when you look more deeply into even counties that are ranked amongst the healthiest, that there are ways in which not everybody in that county is able to thrive. Mm. And so it's really important for places like Ozaukee County in Wisconsin or other high-ranked counties in other states to look into the data. And we are able to disaggregate data for many of the measures so that you can look particularly at different racial and ethnic groups in your county that may or may not be experiencing the same level of health as the majority population. And again, that's often because of longstanding, deep-rooted policies and practices that may impact whether some groups have access to employment or access, again, like I said, to safe, affordable housing. And so we really hope that people will not stop at the overall rank, but will really take a deeper dive and make sure that unfair gaps that are avoidable and often preventable are addressed.
Sherry, you have this bird's eye view of the whole country and how the whole country is doing. How does Wisconsin compare in general to other parts of America?
Right. So our data is county level data. So you'd have to look at America's health rankings to take a statewide, state by state comparison. So our usual approach is to publish a national key findings approach, key findings report. This year, we did not publish that national report in respect for the work that local and state public health is focused on.
The pandemic, yeah. Right.
Exactly. So, but please do look at America's health rankings to get a overview of how Wisconsin as a state compares to other states across the country, across a number of similar measures.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with Sherry Johnson, who is director of the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison. We're learning about its annual nationwide county health rankings and how Wisconsin communities are doing. What factors do you think are the most important in your health? Education, income, zip code, lifestyle. What needs did the pandemic expose or worsen in your community? What steps does your community need to take now? Join in 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Sherry, for several years, County Health Rankings has curated strategies for how communities can get healthier. Are there some simple strategies that have been shown to really make a difference?
That's a wonderful question. Yes, we have What Works for Health, which is a national database of evidence-informed strategies that can help communities look at what are the opportunities to make a difference. And we curated a list of strategies that may contribute to a equitable recovery from COVID-19. And so people can look specifically at that curated list. But there are things like the earned income tax credit and paid sick leave and debt advice for tenants with unpaid rent that are listed in the database as having either some evidence or scientifically supported evidence that can really get at those root causes of what creates health for a whole community. Child care subsidies are another example of a scientifically supported policy and practice that can support families, working parents, and parents who have young children to allow them to have their children access high quality early education, which we know contributes over the long run to better health outcomes and higher wages for these young children as adults.
What do you see out of programs that help help people buy homes in their community?
The strategies are organized by those factors. So the physical environment is it includes housing, and so I would encourage people to just search the database to look for strategies that relate to housing. For example, the lead paint abatement programs are rated as scientifically supported. We know that in many communities in Wisconsin, there are still high risks of exposure to lead, and that lead has long-term effects on our children's health and ability to be successful in school. And so lead beta payment programs are one of the strategies in What Works for Health in the housing area that local communities can consider how they might address that challenge.
Sherry, what has the pandemic revealed about the vulnerabilities of our communities, and what will you be watching for in the data in the coming years?
So we anticipate next year to see in our data the impacts of COVID-19, and we're hopeful that there's an opportunity to work together across local, state, and national efforts to really learn from the pandemic and learn about what it would take to create conditions for everyone to be healthy. So we are hopeful that these differences in how long and how well people are living because of where they live or who they are can be addressed by evidence-informed policies. I think the goal of these data is to shine a light on the factors that drive health and to support local communities that are really ready to take action. There's no one solution, however, and each community needs to decide what's best for them.
No one size fits all. Sherry, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much. Have a good day.
You too. Sherry Johnson, director of the Population Health Institute at UW-Madison, publishes the county health rankings and roadmap report every year. Ahead this hour, it's Wisconsin Life, and then we continue our Friday series on this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. News update is next. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. With us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Ahead this hour, we look at two of this year's Best Picture nominees for the Academy Awards. Have you seen The Father or Judas and the Black Messiah? What do you think of these films? Let's talk 800-642-1234. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Wisconsin question about a county and its curious shape.
Dunn County in western Wisconsin once had access to the Mississippi River. Its early boundary held for a few years until its southernmost portion got swept up in politics and emerged as Pepin County. Liz Domes-Harder brings us the answer to a Wisconsin question about how Pepin County got its unique shape.
Take a look at a map of Wisconsin. It's 65,000 square miles, cut into 72 counties by relatively boxy borders. There are some exceptions. For one, Pepin County in western Wisconsin that shares a border with the Mississippi River.
The shape of this county looks like a square root symbol, and it's super tiny.
That's Joe Hackbarth. He's a physical education teacher at La Crosse Logan High School. As a fan of geography, he wanted to know how Pepin County got its shape.
I should probably say I have nothing against Pepin County, but I saw the map and it just struck me as, well, that's kind of curious. You know, why does it exist?
When Wisconsin became a state, there already were 28 counties. Here's Howard Varigan, the state's cartographer.
Pepin was part of what was then Chippewa County, which at that time was a much larger entity than Chippewa County is today.
Basically, a wide strip from the Mississippi River northeast to present-day Iron County. Large counties weren't ideal back in the day, especially when services were dispatched from the county seat. For Chippewa County, that was Chippewa Falls.
At Pepin, when we were part of Chippewa, it took 2 days to ride to Chippewa Falls.
That's Terry Mesh. Behind a face mask, he points to a framed map showing the county's former boundary. The map is hung in the hall of the Old Courthouse Museum in Durand, where Mesh is a volunteer manager and tour guide.
So the closer you were to the seat of justice, the sooner you would get service, etc. That's what drove the creation of smaller and smaller counties.
Some men fought hard for that. Men like William Boyd Newcomb, who platted the village of Pepin. In his fight, Newcomb helped carve a piece out of Chippewa County to establish Dunn County. Dunn County was divided into seven new townships. In the south were Pepin and Bear Creek.
William Boyd Newcomb merely asked for the severing, cutting off, of these two townships and forming them into Pepin County.
Why? Because he felt slighted by the county he had a hand in establishing. In 1854, he was appointed Dunn County Register of Deeds to fill a vacant seat. Finding qualified applicants was often hard for fledgling counties, and Dunn County was no different.
Dunn County was having such a problem organizing that the state legislature stepped in and they set a new election for November of 1855, before the two-year cycle of a normal term.
Newcomb was effectively ousted from his Dunn County office.
His feelings got hurt bad enough for him to now begin the process of creating a whole new county.
Lots of folks were against the new county, including two assemblymen who demanded that their minority opinion be written into the assembly journal. That opinion piece is printed and framed in the museum. For theatrics, it's read aloud by Mesh.
The shape of the new county is such as necessarily, at first look, must strike everyone of the impropriety of the division. And I upon the map will speak a loud language.
Not exactly loud enough. Pepin became a county on February 25th, 1858.
WPR's Liz Domes-Harder brought us that story on the curious shape of Pepin County. And that story idea came from an audience member as part of our Wisconsin project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Life segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now for some Oscar buzz. On Fridays in April, we make space to talk about this year's Best Picture nominees leading up to Sunday's Academy Awards ceremony. And next up, The Father, starring Anthony Hopkins, Olivia Colman, and Mark Gatiss. Here's a bit from the trailer.
Laura has come round to help you.
I don't need her or anyone else. I can manage very well on my own.
Everything all right?
Who are you?
Actually, it's me, Paul.
Who?
I live here.
What is this nonsense? Anne?
It's me.
Ah, there she is.
Your father seemed a bit confused.
Have you seen this film? Join in 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is a senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater and teaches courses on film. Anna, welcome back.
Hi, welcome. I'm happy to be here.
Oh,
again
well,
the last time.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Let's dig into The Father, which is so heartbreaking. Tell us a little bit about this film.
So The Father is about kind of a man's descent into dementia. And the film is told from this character's perspective, portrayed in a really fascinating way here by Anthony Hopkins. Mm. And it is an incredible performance. More on that in a bit. But it stars Hopkins as this character who is, you know, kind of the title character. And, we have seen these kinds of stories before, and they are, generally fairly depressing films. But this film, I would really encourage your listeners to check out, because it is such a creatively told film. And it tells what makes this film a real standout is that it tells the story from the perspective of this character. And so we are as the audience, we are just as disoriented as our title character is. And the director is a first-time director, Florian Zeller. He is constantly playing tricks on the audience. And that is meant, I think, in a large part to mimic what's going on in the mind of our lead character. And so while it is, again, it's a sad story, it is a really interesting way to tell, how this story unfolds. And because we're never quite sure, sort of as the audience, kind of what's going on. And it's really interesting. It's just a really interesting film.
And this is adapted from a play. How does that work cinematically?
So the film is, it does have some stage qualities to it, clearly. But what the director accomplishes is that it also, works cinematically. And there are little things, little clues, right, that we are given as the audience that I think it makes it really work as a cinematic film. And Zeller, he's French, a Frenchman, and I was into some interesting background information on Zeller. He began his career as a novelist. Hmm. Then he pivoted to playwriting. The Father, yes, was started as a play, and then This has been the first film that Zeller has adapted as from one of his very own plays to film. And, you know, again, there are little things that you can accomplish clearly with cinema that you can't obviously accomplish in a play-like format. And ultimately, it just really works well. And one point I've heard that, you know, this is a play, and it's been compared in some ways from just a staging perspective to the film Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which did not get a Best Picture nod. And one of the reasons is that there were some critics that say that it felt really stagey, that film feels really stagey. But that's not the way, that's not the case with The Father. It really does have a cinematic feel, despite it beginning its life as a play.
What made Anthony Hopkins' performance here so special?
Well, he is someone that is, slowly, descending into dementia, and he conveys that incredibly well. The kind of, some of the emotions that he brings to this, to his performance, the sort of the confusion, the defensiveness, disorientation, all of that is personified very well by Hopkins. And he did win the BAFTA award, the sort of the equivalent of the British Academy Awards. And so there is, the conventional wisdom says that, the late Chadwick Boseman may win the Academy Award for his performance in Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. But I have heard sort of reports that there's sort of some late breaking surge for Hopkins and his performance in this film. And I believe it really is his very best performance since his turn as Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs, which, of course, is such a memorable role.
Yeah.
This is obviously entirely different, an entirely different performance. But it's a real, it's a real testament to, if Hopkins wins, he would be the oldest living Best Actor winner, and he's at the age of 82. And that's, again, a real testament to his endurance as a performer, for sure.
Well, you touched on this, but the subject of dementia is so heavy, so sad. Is the movie still entertaining in ways?
Well, I find myself, being entertained. It has this kind of devastating ending, which I won't give away, but it keeps you guessing. And it is maybe perhaps a film I'm not necessarily sure I'd, sit through multiple viewings. But part of me actually does want to watch it again because, again, all of these clues, all of these elements to the film that, again, we are, the way the film is set up is such a creative perspective, such a creative point of view. And the way little set pieces change over the course of the film, that is what makes it such an interesting film. Even though it is, again, the subject matter is not the most uplifting in a way, but the performances are incredible. I mean, and then I haven't even mentioned Olivia Colman, who, here she is, someone who's playing Queen Elizabeth on The Crown.
Yeah.
But then turning out this incredible performance in this film as well. She's a former Oscar winner for her performance as Queen Anne in The Favourite. So she is just also a stellar, gives a stellar performance as well.
We're talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick, Senior Lecturer, UW-Whitewater. Which performances did you enjoy watching in The Father or Judas and the Black Messiah? Who deserves an Oscar Sunday? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is an Oscar-nominated original song by her from the movie Judas and the Black Messiah. The track is Fight For You. So these Fridays in April, we're setting aside time to talk about this year's nominees for Best Picture ahead of the Academy Awards on Sunday. Have you seen Judas and the Black Messiah, about the events leading up to the killing of Black Panther chairman Fred Hampton? Join in, 800-642-1234. Anna Thompson-Hodgick is here, senior lecturer at UW-Whitewater. She's our guide. So, Anna, now we're back in the 60s for this historical drama, Judas and the Black Messiah. Can you give us a little bit of sketch?
Yes. So this film is the story of Fred Hampton, who was the leader of the Black Panthers, the Illinois chapter of the Black Panthers. And that chapter was, in real life, was infiltrated by a young FBI informant, William O'Neill. And Hampton was an incredibly charismatic leader, but there was a real fear of him and his rise in power from the FBI, and this is personified in a rather sinister portrayal in the film by Martin Sheen. Daniel Kaluuya plays Fred Hampton in a turn that's, you know, quite a strong performance, and Kaluuya was nominated in this performance for Best Supporting Actor. And, you know, this is a film probably from a plot perspective has the most overlap with the trial of the Chicago Seven a film we talked about a few weeks ago. But the primary themes here are social justice and, you know, clearly making it, like so many of our nominated films this year, incredibly timely in terms of thinking about, you know, these elements of social justice and the fight for civil rights. It's a really powerful film as well.
Well, let's hear some of Daniel Kaluuya capturing Chairman Fred Hampton at a rally in the film.
It's not a question of violence or nonviolence. It's a question of resistance to fascism or non-existence within fascism. You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter.
So what do you think of Kaluuya's performance?
It is really incredible. And, you know, Kaluuya, you know, is fascinating. He is actually a British actor, and you'd never know it from that performance. He very much, you know, studied the cadence of Hampton's speeches, and worked actually with both a dialect coach and an opera coach.
Wow.
Who really have a command of the way Hampton spoke, and really to try to, you know, more deeply understand the way Hampton gave speeches and really was able to sort of command the room. And it is a really, it's really good. And so the thing too that makes this film quite notable, that this is the first time as well in Oscar history that the producer team for this movie is entirely African American. And so that is really notable. So you generally have, you know, somebody in the background, right, that's raising the money in mm-hmm. some way. And so, like, for example, last week we talked about Minari and, you know, Brad Pitt being one of the producers of that film. This time it is, again, an entirely African-American producer team. And so if this film wins Best Picture, it would go, those Oscars would go to Ryan Coogler, I believe, who is quite a force in Hollywood. He mm-hmm. was the director of Black Panther. And then the director is, again, another first-time director, not nominated for this particular film, but Shaka King is his name. And so he also is behind the producer team. And this is a film, too, that took a long time to get made. A lot of these kinds of movies do take some time. They had been shopping the screenplay around Hollywood for the past 7 years. And finally, you know, got this film greenlit about 2 years ago. So that just the story of the film getting made in the first place, I find to be really, really interesting as well.
What do you take away from Lakeith Stanfield's performance as an FBI informant and infiltrating the Black Panthers?
So we really do see Stanfield's performance, you know, he brings that conflict, that inner turmoil, certainly. And, you know, the backstory here is that he was sort of a petty criminal in Chicago. He is approached by the FBI in exchange, you know, the various charges against him are dropped. And so, you know, he proceeds to infiltrate the group. He stays with the Black Panthers after Hampton's assassination, ultimately. And then, you know, eventually reveals that he's an informant and gives an interview very famously with the documentary Eyes on the Prize in 1989.
Yeah.
And that also is – so that real footage of his interview is blended into the narrative of the film. And that particularly is really, really powerful as well. And so – there's a little bit of controversy because Academy Award controversy because both Stanfield and Kahlua are nominated for Best Supporting Actor awards, so they are in the same category, and so there was some talk of, you know, well, shouldn't one of these two men be nominated in the primary award mm-hmm. category? And so that's also interesting, and so it'll be, you know, to see if they split the vote, all right, from this film, or if Kahlua is able, he's favored at this point to win Best Supporting Actor, but there's some, you know, discussion that they may split the vote, and then another actor may take that category. So
all we can do is watch and wait. We're talking with Anna Thompson-Hodgick, who teaches film at UW-Whitewater. Marcy is joining us from Stevens Point. Hi, Marcy. What is your movie-going experience like?
Oh, hi. Yes, I'm an avid moviegoer. It's my preference always to see the movies in the movie show. The experience of the lights down is just one of my favorites. This year, I've gone to at least 5-6 movies, and more than once, I've been the only person in the movies. But my real issue really is it's been becoming increasingly sad for me because for various reasons, for example, streaming or political reasons, some of the movies are just movies that I will never have an opportunity to see. Whenever the Oscars, it's kind of like my Super Bowl night. But in the past couple of years, so many movies are so obscure or picked. Actually, they're chosen, and the people chosen for what I perceive as primarily political reasons, that the experience, like this year, I'm going to watch the Oscars, but I'm going to see that there's movies that I've never even seen or I won't have an opportunity to see. And a lot, I'm just going to make a prediction, a lot are going to be just going to be picked for political reasons. You're going to see a lot of picked people. Black nominees are going to be selected because of what's going on in the country.
Yeah, Marcy, we're short on time. Anna, your thoughts there very quickly.
So, I mean, there's a real fear that, you know, will movie theaters rebound, in the coming year, in the coming years, about, you know, that the streaming revolution has maybe diminished certainly the power of the theater. And, notably, you have a lot of the really, you know, kind of well-known directors like, for example, Spielberg, who's kept, you know, his production of West Side Story just totally out of the field of Academy Award nominees. And he's holding out till next year to release that film, even though it's been completed for months.
And, all right, we only have a few seconds, but do you have a pick? Do you have a pick for Best Picture?
Nomadland is my pick to win. Nomadland. It's won all the early awards, so it's a pretty good indicator that Nomadland will win. So.
Well, Anna, thank you so much. You've done the best to school us. This has been fun.
Yes, it has. Thank you.
Anna Thompson-Hodgick with UW-Whitewater. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and this is the Ideas Network.